lined up around the Christmas tree, putting on ornaments, looking a little lost in their faces, but ultimately having a good time. And breakfast includes crafts night before Christmas. We have four substantial pictures. One is with a group of family, a mom and a dad and their two daughters, both ginger, looking like they're cooking and having a good time. Another one to the right of it is a mom with their child sitting in their lap. Then we have one on the bottom left corner with three kids posted up next to Santa Claus having a good time. And then we have another group of kids with Santa Claus on the right of that picture, looking back on it, having a good time, and taking around for a Christmas carriage. Then we have Glenwood regroups after bond issue fails. This is by Tim Rower. Glenwood school officials hope to have a formal plan in the next few weeks on how to proceed following an unsuccessful bond referendum. A $39.9 million bond issue for numerous renovations and infrastructure needs failed to garner the necessary numbers of votes for passage in the November 7th election. "We don't have a plan of action yet," Glenwood Community Schools Superintendent Devin Embrary told the nonprofit rally this week. "Hopefully we'll have a formal plan moving forward in late December or early June. Of the nearly 2,000 ballots cast, 59% opposed the measure that would have been the district's largest ever general obligated bond to date. Among the various proposed projects, the bond was to be used for an extensive renovation of Northeast Elementary School, including a new day care wing, which is currently housed on the Glenwood Resource Center campus. The other projects involved a new multipurpose gymnasium, administration offices, security enhancements, and infrastructure updates in the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. Funds would also have been used to update and establish an innovation center and HVAC upgrades at the middle school." Embry said that, according to public feedback, most voters were in favor of the bond, but they opposed the new daycare center. And then you can see Glenwood in page A2, which I will get to. Next, on the side panel, we have a title copied, "Council Oklahoma's Investments for FY 2025. This is a Council Bluffs by David Golbitz. "Repairs to city infrastructure are among the city priorities according to the Capital Improvement Program, approved by the Council Bluffs City Council during the November 27th meeting. The plan for fiscal years 2025 to 2029 lists proposed projects, the years in which each project will begin, the estimated cost of each project, and how the city intends to pay for them. The Capital Improvement Program is kind of a budgeting document for our big capital projects," Council Bluffs Chief of Staff Brandon Garrett told the nonprofit rally. "It's a five-year outlook of what we're going to be working on. The first year of the plan, fiscal year 25, is part of the city's yearly budget, meaning that they can be funded, while the other 4 years are more aspirational. Some things have to happen before others, so there's timing issues. And as we open up the CIP for next year, we'll say, okay, well, we weren't able to get this one done in fiscal year 25, so we cannot do this one, another one in fiscal year 26. We'll have to push that back again," Garrett said. "In 2025, the city plans to replace or repair the parking lots at Big Lake and Valley View Parks as well as the..." And this continues on to the next. "Mills Crossing gets boost from BNSF," this next article says, by Tim Rower. "A large Mills County development site just got a boost in attracting a new business. The Mills Crossing megasite, just east of Glenwood, has earned a location, a certified site design nation from Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. We're really excited about it," said Andrew Rainbolt, executive director of the Mills County Economic Development Foundation. "It certainly a confirmation that we have a competitive site. The Mills County site was one of three locations that the railroads recently awarded this designation to. The others began in Fort Madison and DeSoto, Kansas. We are pleased to add these three new locations to our list of growing certified sites. Across BNSF's network, said Chris Dedos, Assistant Vice President of the Economic Development, it's a win-win for our customers who are ready to develop their business offerings through rail, saving them several months of construction time. To be considered sites must undergo a thorough analysis, which includes an evaluation of environmental and geotechnical standards, available utilities, site available, and existing and proposed infrastructure. The goal of the program is to provide an inventory of rail-served sites that are available for immediate development. The Mills County site covers about 1,700 acres, about a mile or so east of Glenwood. It's close to interstate highways via a four-lane highway and is within the Omaha metropolitan area. This site is adjacent to the Burlington National Main Line through the county, Rainbow said. It is fully served by the electric and natural gas systems of MidAmerican Energy, he added. The site has also been certified by Iowa Economic Development Authority. The site, currently used as farm ground, has received some serious interest from potential tenants, Rainbow said. Ideally, the site would be home to a major business with enough land for smaller ones, possibly in support of the major business, he said. Development of the site is particularly important now that the country's largest employer, the Glenwood Resource Center, is closing, Rainbow said. We need economic development, he said. We need jobs. That was the end of that article. Next article is titled AMC Theaters Pulls Out of Des Moines Market. And we have a picture of the AMC Theater from the Jordan Creek Mall, it looks like. AMC Theaters has dropped the curtain on the Des Moines metropolitan area. The movie theater chains last Des Moines metro location, AMC Classic Johnson 16, closed Sunday, November 26, according to media reports. We hope to see you at our next nearest location, AMC Berry Woods 24. AMC says on its website, referring to Kansas City area theater, the Johnson Theater opened in 1998 and was fully renovated in 2016, according to the Des Moines Register. AMC bought the theater's owner later in 2016, along with the theaters in Urbandale and Des Moines, and all three AMC-owned theaters closed over the past 13 months. KCCI reported that the Johnson location is listed for sale. AMC operates a 17-screen theater in Council Bluffs at 3220 23rd Avenue. The company, the largest chain in the world, also has theaters in Sioux City and Dubuque, as well as Restroads Mall in Omaha. AMC closed its theater at Omaha's Oakview Mall in 2020, and B&B Theaters reopened the 24-screen theater last year. This is where the next stories are digest. There's three of them. The first one is titled, Council Bluffs Man Dies in Omaha Crash. A 36-year-old Council Bluffs man died in a three-vehicle crash along Interstate 80 in Omaha. The crash happened in the interstate westbound lanes near I Street around 1 a.m. Saturday, a Nebraska State Patrol spokesperson said. An investigation found that the driver of a Honda Accord lost control and struck the concrete barrier that served as a median. The Honda came to stop in the travel lane. A semi-trailer truck driver pulled over to help the driver of the Honda. At the time, a Chevrolet Express van driven by Tanner Mudra struck the Honda and then struck the semi. Mudra died at the scene. The Honda's driver was taken by Omaha Fire Department medics to Creighton University Medical Center, Bergen Mercy, to be treated for serious injuries. The semi driver was not injured. This is from Omaha World Herald. This next one is called Two Omaha Teen Dies in a Crash by Creston. Two teenagers from Omaha were killed in a crash Friday evening in Union County, according to the Iowa Department of Public Safety. A Ford Explorer was headed eastbound on Highway 34 of Creston around 7 p.m. when a semi trailer truck turned left into the highway from Iris Avenue, and the Ford collided with a grain hopper, and the semi was pulling, according to the report. The report said driver of the Ford, 17-year-old Isabella Martinez, along with 18-year-old passenger Connor Masuth, were both pronounced dead at the scene. A third passenger, a 14-year-old, was injured and taken to a hospital. All three were from Omaha. The 63-year-old driver of the semi-truck was uninjured. Then we have, next one is called Arrest Made in Teen's Fatal Shooting. Omaha police have arrested a man in connection with the fatal shooting of a 17-year-old Mauricio Chavez on November 17th. Zadico Motino, 18, is suspected of second-degree murder in the killing of Chavez, who was found suffering from a gunshot wound at the Sipe and Sirens bar at 42nd and 8th Streets around 11:15 p.m. that night. According to a new release from Omaha Police Department, Chavez was taken to the Nebraska Medical Center with life-saving measures in progress, but he was declared dead at the hospital, police previously said. Motino is also suspected of use of a weapon to commit a felony in possession of a deadly weapon by a prohibited person, and also had an active felony warrant out of Sarpy County. According to the release, the investigation remains ongoing. Our next story is titled, New Recruiting Dog Walking Volunteers, by Mariah Garcia, Midlands Humane Society. Volunteers are essential to Midlands Humane Society, and 200-plus animals in our care each and every day, from general cleaning to medical assistance. There is always an opportunity to spark your interest in animal welfare and allow you to make a difference in the lives of homeless pets. The biggest need for volunteers at MHS currently is growing our dog walking team. With the adoption floor at max capacity, dog walkers are vital in ensuring the dogs have time outside of their kennels and their fresh air to get physical and mental stimulation. It's understandable that people may be hesitant to begin their dog walking volunteerism in the winter months, but this is when we truly need your help. Wintertime sees a decrease in volunteer participation for dog walking. However, dogs rely on their routine of going outside for potty breaks, playtime, and one-on-one socializing, and consistency helps to alleviate stress. In the colder months, many dogs do not require long walks as they like to do their business quickly and get back inside to curl up on their blanket or dog bed. We can't always guarantee this with our huskies, though they like to spend as much time as possible in the snow, it seems. Don't forget, this is also a great way to your daily exercise when the days seem to so much shorter. So how do you become a dog walking volunteer? Easy. The first step is to attend a volunteer orientation, and you can do so either in person or at MHS or by joining a convenient online session. There is a $25 registration fee, which gets you a volunteer t-shirt, name tag, lanyard, and allows regularly scheduled volunteer appreciation events throughout the year. Dog walking shifts are 8 to 11 a.m. and 3 to 6 p.m. weekdays, and 8 to 11 a.m. and 2 to 5 p.m. weekends. To ask volunteers to complete at minimum one docking shift per week to stay updated on policies, procedures, and the specified needs of the dogs on the adopted floor. The minimum age to volunteer is 13 with an adult, and the minimum age to walk dogs is 16. Orientation dates are listed on the Midlands Humane Society website. Contact volunteer and foster care coordinator Derek Rollins at drollins@midlandshumanesociety.org or 712-396-2263 with any questions. We understand that not all animal lovers have a schedule conducive to volunteering, so we ask that you consider donating towards the care of the thousands of animals MHS serves in Council Bluffs and Pottawatomie County each year by participating in our year-end annual fundraiser, Bark Friday. This year we have a goal of raising $60,000, and we need your help to reach this goal by December 31st. You can easily do online at MidlandsHumaneSociety.org or mail or stop by in person at 1020 Railroad Avenue, Council Bluffs, Iowa 515-3003. All donations are tax deductible at MHS, nonprofit organization. Thank you for your continued support of MHS animals, staff, and volunteers, and very grateful for your contributions. End of that article. Next article is titled, Ireland Shows Fallacy of Guns Don't Kill Trope. with a subheadline saying, with strong restrictions, its death rate from firearms is far below America's carnage. The knife attack that wounded an adult and three children in Dublin recently and subsequent anti-migrant rioting there demonstrated the ways in which the U.S. and Ireland are part of the same chilling trajectory of political violence and intolerance that is wracking so much of the world today, as well as that one big way in which America remains a tragic outlier from the other advanced nations. Driven by unconfirmed rumors that the knife-wielding assailant outside a Dublin school was an Algerian immigrant, some 500 rioters rampaged through the capital city, smashing windows and burning police cars, some holding Irish Lives Matters signs. America is, sadly, not alone these days regarding the hateful xenophobia of many in the political right. But the attack that started it was notably different from what Americans are used to, in that there was initially at least no death toll. That could yet change. A 5-year-old girl was in critical condition with stab wounds. Still, it doesn't discount the horror to note that when sociopaths go on to attempted murder sprees in gun-happy America, they're genuinely far more successful than their counterparts in other advanced nations. That's because, unlike in Ireland and the rest of the advanced world, it's easy for practically anyone in America to lay their hands on a semi-automated firearm. The gun lobby and its Republican water carriers have made sure of that by consistently blocking such common sense reforms as universal background checks and red flag laws. The differing outcomes that result are sobering. On the same day that Ireland was rocked to its core by four stabbings, more than 100 Americans nationwide likely died by the gun, based on daily average statistics. The American victims on Thanksgiving Day, the same day the Irish stabbings occurred, including a 16-year-old boy found dead in an SUV in Cahokia Heights, Illinois. Other fatal shootings that day were logged in or around Indianapolis, Milwaukee, Chicago, Los Angeles, and elsewhere. None of it spawned global or even national news coverage, let alone riots, because we're used to it. The ponder that dichotomy and then ponder the gun culture trope that guns don't kill, people will kill. The plain falsity of the trope is evident not just in these tragic anecdotes, but in the data. In the U.S., which has by far the loosest gun laws in the advanced world and by far the most guns per person, also has by far the highest gun mortality both in total numbers and per capita. Every year, about 40,000 Americans die from firearms, homicides, suicides, or accidents. That's a rate of about 12 deaths per 100,000 population, according to data from the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention. Ireland, what is strong restrictions on firearms, experiences well under one gun death per 100,000 citizens. Generally, it totals about 50 deaths per year. Wow. Yes, unfettered access to guns does kill people. Newsom, that is the end of that article. Next, at the top, we have a little My View chip box, and it's a little graphic with the capital on one side. It says, option A, Russia invades Ukraine. And the state capital has a quote box saying, send your money. Then option B, titled, Russian wins and invades NATO. The capital is saying, send your sons. And the next one. In this article there, it's titled, Newsom DeSantis debate offers more heat than light. The hyped debate between Gavin Newsom and Ron DeSantis last week was never going to be more than a brief sideshow running panel to the main attraction, the actual campaign for the White House. California's Democratic governor is now not a candidate for president. Florida's governor is running for the Republican nomination, but doing so poorly that he stopped to participate in a particularly stunt dressed dressed up as National Policy Forum that fairly reeked with the smell of DeSantis' desperation. Even of these meager standards, the great red versus blue state debate, as Fox News breathlessly promoted the cable TV throwdown, proved a dud. "There's nothing but a bully," Newsom taunted. "You're a bully," DeSantis shot back. And so it went for more than 90 excruciating minutes, at least on those occasions when the two weren't talking past or over each other. A good debate, or one that's worth its while, illuminates issues, parses differences, and sheds light on the persona of its participants. Last week's affair was an exercise in affirmation, underscoring much of what we've already grasped to it. Newsom and DeSantis generally despise each other. They have vastly different approaches and philosophies to govern their sprawling, variegated states. Fox News is a propaganda arm of the Republican Party with little pretense of fairness or balance. The evening's ringmaster, Sean Hannity, had pledged to be an even-handed and impartial facilitator, but the oh-so-soft questions he gently lofted DeSantis left no doubt where Hannity's rooting interest lay. The blazing red tie he wore should have been a giveaway. Each segment was prefaced a selective battery of statistics on crime, gas prices, education, homelessness, that painted California as just a hair's breadth of capsizing and sliding ingloriously into the ocean. Despite that obvious advantage, it was DeSantis who seemed ill at ease, looking like a man suffering hernia as he prepared to face a root canal. "That's a lie," was his standard rejoinder. "You are just jabbering," DeSantis said during another bristling back and forth. "Anytime you are uncomfortable, you just make stuff up," Newsom responded. For California's governor, who loves gambling on a national stage, the whole evening was a lark. He has taunted DeSantis from long distance for more than a year and plainly enjoyed being able to shiv him up close. A broad grin telegraphed his glee. "You're trolling folks to try to get some news attention to you can't out Trump. Newsom said, referencing the commanding GOP frontrunner. "And by the way, how's that going for you, Ron? You're down 41 points in your own home state. Ouch." The subplot of the evening was Newsom's supposed shadow campaign, as DeSantis called it, to wrest the Democratic nominating from aged incumbent President Joe Biden. But California's governor was utterly slavish in the role of dutiful party soldier, repeatedly extolling Biden's performance with a rat-a-tat of statistics, a Newsom hallmark, on falling inflation, rising employment, and other favorable barometers. He even leapt to the defense of his old frenemy, Vice President Kamala Harris, when DeSantis mispronounced her first name. Deliberately, it seems. "It's Kamala," Newsom sounded out, "Madam Vice President, to you." Much has been made of the showdown as a possible preview of the 2028 presidential campaign, but the contest is political eons away. Comparisons also have been made to the debate between California Governor Ronald Reagan and New York Senator Robert Kennedy, two other political celebrities who staged a similar exhibition match in May 1967. The two were seen as prospective presidential rivals. But even though Reagan's performance in the sober matchup was widely lauded, it took three tries and more than a dozen years before he finally made it to the White House. Newsom might be considered the winner from last week's debate, if there was such a thing, simply by making DeSantis show up and debate him as an equal. But it's highly unlikely that anything said or done on the red and blue themed soundstage outside Atlanta will change the trajectory of the 2024 campaign. The best that can be said is that, given an opportunity to extend the forum beyond its scheduled 90 minutes, Ann Newsom certainly seemed eager to go on. Fox mercifully spared its audience and passed. Here's hoping for no repeat. Baraback is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And that is the end of that article. 70,000 are jetting to climate confab in oil country, titled this next article. How many people do you think it takes to hammer out a global climate agreement? 500? 5,000? 50,000? Apparently the correct answer is 70,000. That's about how many people are expected to turn up in Dubai over the next few weeks for COP28, the latest United Nations climate confab. This is up from 49,704 at COP27 last year in Egypt, and 38,457 in at COP26 in Scotland. Attendance has more than tripled since 2019. In COP's early years, attendance averaged just 5,000. Whether this explosion is a sign that the world is taking climate change more seriously or just the bloat that naturally accumulates around gatherings of humans who control large pools of political and financial capital remains to be seen. It's difficult to be optimistic. Many of those 70,000 people will spend days continuing a years-long argument over whether the world should phase fossil fuels out or down, or whether those fossil fuels should instead be abated by carbon capture technology. Meanwhile, big oil producers are still moving full steam ahead on phasing those fuels up, rapidly shrinking the window of opportunity to limit global heating to just 1.5 Celsius above pre-industrial averages. If one wanted to be nitpicky about it, one could argue that 70,000 people riding airplanes on an oil country on an Arabian peninsula to talk about climate change feels a bit like staging an AA meeting in a Fort Lauderdale nightclub during spring break. You risk losing sight of the purpose. To be fair, if those 70,000 people all fly commercial, then their climate impact might not be too ludicrous. A first-class round trip from New York's JFK Airport to Dubai produces about roughly 3 tons of carbon dioxide emissions per passenger. According to a UN calculator, that's less than a quarter of the carbon pollution the average American produces in a year. Flying economy cuts that impact in half again. By comparison, Taylor Swift's private jet flights produced nearly 8,300 tons of carbon dioxide in 2022 by one estimate. Then again, 70,000 people producing 2,100,000 tons of carbon dioxide for the one Dubai shindig is equivalent or more than 25 Taylor Swift years. An untold scores of those COP attendees won't be flying commercial. They'll be taking private jets, which generate 100 times more carbon pollution per passenger than commercial ones. The standard defense of such excess is that to get very important people to very important talks, you might have to accept a risk that less important people will suffer a bit more sea level rise, drought, or wildfire in the future. And as climate talks have become more complicated, they have naturally required more bodies to work on them. This year's COP won't just be haggling over words like down and out. It will also involve detailed negotiations over climate finance and a stock take accounting of exactly how far the world has come in fighting climate change. Spoiler alert, not very. It might also involve fossil fuel campaigns, companies pledging to end methane emissions by 2030, which would actually be a huge development. Still, if these meetings are so to be constructive in the future, then they'll need to consider bloat. In a 2021 study, the European Capacity Building Initiative, a group focused on making climate talks less terrible, suggested pruning COPs back to 5,000. People doing the boring technical work of putting trees into action. Other business could be spread across smaller confabs throughout the year. The ECBI suggested including a global climate action week that would fulfill humanity's need for dog and pony shows, attracting the world leaders, celebrities, and grifters. Currently turning COP into Green Davis. That still sounds like a lot of flying, unfortunately, but maybe it would be more productive too. That is the end of that article. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for December 5th, 2023. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Catherine from Drake University. IRIS volunteer, love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Moving on to obituaries. Judith K. Lee obituary. Judith K. Lee, age 82, passed away December 2nd, 2023 in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Judith was born June 3rd, 1941 in Tacoma, Washington, to the late Lyle Ross and Charlotte Brewer. She was raised along with her brother, Ted Brewer, in the loving home of Lester and Charlotte Brewer in Letcher, South Dakota. Judith married J.K. Lee and was blessed with a son, James K. Lee. Judith loved her flower gardens and her family and friends. In addition to her parents, Judith is preceded in death by her husband, J.K. Lee, stepdaughter, Maxine Loftus. Judith is survived by her son, James Kim Lee, brother, Ted Brewer, Tanya Lee, and Elsie O'Banion, special friend, Clara Schneider, grandchildren, Jennifer Lee, Jordan, Justine, Harix, Kyle, Zaludek, James Lee, seven great-grandchildren, many nieces and nephews. Visitation, Wednesday, 5 to 7 p.m. Funeral service, Thursday, 9:30 a.m. All at Cutler O'Neill Mayor Woodring Funeral Home. Judith will be laid to rest at Walnut Hill Cemetery. Our next one is another lady. Her name is another person named Robert P. McCampbell Jr., August 7th, 1957 to November 26, 2023, preceded in death by Father Robert P. McCampbell, survived by children Joshua Robert McCampbell, Joseph Robert McCampbell, Robert Palmer, Trey McCampbell III, grandson, Tyler Matthew McCampbell, mother Bunny Adkins, brother J.L. McCampbell, sister Caroline Freak, nieces and nephews. Mass of Christian burial Wednesday, December 6th at 10 a.m. at St. Mary Magdalene Catholic Church. Interment Omaha National Cemetery at 1:30 p.m. in lieu of flowers. Memorials to the Negro League Hall of Fame in Kansas City, Missouri, or Muddy Paws Second Chance Rescue. And then this next obituary is Karen Crow Messling. Karen Crow Messling joined her parents in heaven on Friday, December 1st, 2023, at home in Council Bluffs, Iowa. She was born to William and Lily Cron on June 11th, 1941, on the Henry Crone farm northeast of Avoca, Iowa, in Fairview Township. In 1959, she started work as an IBM key punch operator at the Woodman of the World building in Omaha, Nebraska. In 1962, she went to work for Blue Cross Blue Shield in Omaha, Nebraska as a key punch operator, becoming a supervisor for several years. She married the love of her life, Ronald R. Messling, on April 24, 1965, at St. Francis Church in Council Bluffs, Iowa. They lived in Council Bluffs, where they raised their two children, Brad and Michelle, and were married 58 years. Karen was a member of St. Peter's Catholic Church in Council Bluffs, Iowa. She was preceded in death by her parents, William and Lily Cron, sister and brother-in-law, Nadine and Daryl Drieger. Karen is survived by her husband, Ronald Messling, son, Brad Messling, or Gretna, Nebraska, daughter, Michelle, Michigan, grandchildren, Alicia, Grace, of Omaha, Nebraska, Taylor Messling, of Council Bluffs, Iowa, Whitney Messling, of Orwa, Colorado, Payne Messling, of Omaha, Nebraska, Kevin Harkins of Hastings, Nebraska, Grace Harkins of Omaha, Nebraska, Emily Harkins of Omaha, Nebraska, Caitlin Mayer and William Mayer of Howell, Michigan, great-grandchildren Jocelyn Grace, Kobe Bauman, Carter Bauman, Kimma Grace, and Kinley Grace, niece Kimberly Perkins of Omaha, Nebraska, nephew Mark Drager of Council Bluffs, Iowa, and their children Rebecca Malberg and Nathan Drager of Council Bluffs, Iowa. Funeral service is the Hoy Kalansky Funeral Home on Friday, December 8th, 2023 at 2 p.m. Visitation will be during the hour prior to the service. Interment in the Graceland Cemetery in Avoca, Iowa. Memorials are suggested to St. Peter's Catholic Church or Midland Humane Society. Interment is in the Graceland Cemetery in Avoca, Iowa. Our next obituary is Edna Mayer. Edna joined Mayer, age 79, of Council Bluffs, passed away peacefully on December 1st, 2023. Edna was born June 7th, 1944, in Oregon City, Iowa, to the late Edward J. and Elevena E. Denbeast. She graduated from Mapleton High School in 1961 and married Robert F. Mayer on June 30th, 1963. They were married until his passing on November 1st, 2002. Edna worked at the Stockyard Bank in Sioux City, Iowa, in First Year and also First National Bank of Omaha, retiring after more than 45 years in banking. She was an avid reader and always enjoyed a good story. Spending time with family and friends was one of the greatest joys in her life. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by siblings Eleanor Thomas, Edwin, and Edgar Denbeast, and great-grandson Grayson Scott Kinney. Edna is survived by her children Michelle Nymeyer, Chris Lorenza, siblings Eugene Denbeast and Elaine Fainsoroy, grandchildren Brooke Cathell, Roger Kinney, Jillian Gates, Brian Taylor, Evan and Ethan Nymeyer, Caitlin Newton, Dylan, and Megan Lawrence, and 17 great-grandchildren. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, December 7, 2023, at Hoy Kolonsky Funeral Home. Funeral service will be at 11 a.m. on Friday, December 8th, at Hoy Kolonsky Funeral Home. Interment is in the Cedar Lawn Cemetery. And that is it for our obituaries. And now moving on to the sports section, starting off with football. This is titled 2023 All-City Team of the Year. And this is Lewis Central taking the field before defeating Western Dubuque 40-21. In a big picture, you see that all the teammates walking out, but as they are about to play their game. And this is by Austin Heenan. The Nonpareil hereby releases its latest version of the All-City football team. A state champion was crowned. Some school records were broken, and history was made at multiple schools, thus providing the talent was strong in Council Bluffs once again. This team was constructed based on the observations of the Nonpareil staff, all four city coaches' comments and insight, along with the individual postseason accolades. Without further ado, here is the 2023 All-City football team. Offense. Quarterback Brady Hetzel, Jr., Lewis Central. After losing multi-year starter in Braylon Camrad, there was some question at the year of the start as to how the Titans would fill the void. Hetzel provided to be the answer quickly. His confidence and performance grew as the season went along as he tallied up to 2,587 yards and 26 touchdowns through the air. Hetzel also ran for 226 yards and 4 touchdowns, earning him first-team All-State and district honors in Class 4A. The growth that Brady made from Week 1 to Week 13 this year is incredible, Titans coach Justin Camrad said. His athleticism allowed him to make numerous plays, but it was his knowledge of the game, willingness to ask questions, and preparation and understanding the game plan of his opponent that led to his success this season. Playing the quarterback position is more than having a strong arm and athletic ability, and Brady showed that with consistent development this year. Running back Brody Patlin, Jr., Lewis Central. Among the many running backs that lined up in the backfield for Lewis Central, this one turned out to be surprise. Starting lower on the depth chart to start the season, as injuries piled up in the Titans, Patlin eventually got his chance and made the most of it before falling to an injury himself. The junior averaged 7.7 yards per carry, running for a city best 12 touchdowns and 751 yards. He also had 3 receiving touchdowns to earn first-team district honors. Brody was a home run threat when even he touched the ball. Cameron said, despite only playing in 7 games, he was second in the city rushing behind Camden Cross. He led the city and district in rushing touchdowns. That is the end of that article. Next, moving on to the side panel, discussing the NGCAA playoffs. Back to the Ship, titled Back to the Ship, in a subheadline, First Quarter Explosion Leads Ravers Over Kilgore. And this is by the same person, Austin Heenan, for the Nonpareil. Number two, Iowa Western played a dream scenario in the fourth quarter to seize control quickly over number three, Kilgore, and cruise to a 47-7 win to Sunday's NJCAA semifinal playoff game at Titan Stadium in Council Bluffs. From an execution standpoint, this was our best game yet, Rivers head coach Scott Stromier said. Anytime you can make explosive plays like we did to start the game, Jonathan Hample had the big run to make it 14-0. When you have guys make plans like that, that's huge. The Ravers fired the cannons and blew the door down with a touchdown drive to take the lead as Latrio Bonner hauled in a 37-yard touchdown pass with Hunter Watson 3 minutes into the game. The defenses then traded some stops before Kilgore pinned Iowa Western at their own five midway through the quarter. It was a little trouble for the Humball, who took it 95 yards on the drive's first play to make it 14-0. Coach Brandon Anderson has preached on patience, Humble said. I stood back there, waited for something to open up, and it eventually did, and I was off. I got to give props to the offensive line. They're the reason I was able to produce the yards I did along with everyone else. Humple would run the ball 18 times for 132 yards to go with his touchdown. After another defensive stop, the Ravers marched down the field again, and Watson threw the second touchdown pass of the day, this one to Jordan Johnson from 40 yards out, soon after Clev Lubin picked up a fumble on a strip sack and ran 15 yards to the house to bump the lead up to 28-0, which was how the score would stand until the second half. Miller said, four scorers in one quarter, that was the key to the game. You get up on a team that's traveled this far, they're cold, and you get up on them 28-0. I think that's a lot of life out of them. This was the name of the game for us all week, Watson said. We knew we needed to execute, and that's what we did. We went out and executed the plays like we're supposed to, and they're different. The defense dominated like they always do. The Reavers broke their silence with a 29-yard field goal 6 minutes into the third and added a safety to their lead just two plays later to make it 33-0. The offense got back in the groove on the next two drives as Bryant Williams ran a score from 27 yards out. Next drive, Watson threw his third touchdown pass of the day to LJ Fitzpatrick from 13 yards to make it 47-0. And that is the end of that article. This next one is titled, Number 2 Michigan Rolls to Big Ten Title, Earns Top 10 Playoff Seed. This is by Michael Merritt. Indianapolis' Blake Corum scored twice, tying the school record for touchdown runs with 55, and Number 2 Michigan beat Number 18 Iowa 26-0 on Saturday night in the Big Ten Championship game to likely take the top seed in the college football playoff. With Coach Jim Harbaugh back on the sideline for the first time in 4 weeks, the Wolverines 13-0 number 2 CFP routed Iowa 10-3 number 16 CFP to win three straight outrun conference crowns for the first time in school history. We set our goals earlier this year, and this is another one checked off, Corum said. And with number 1 Georgia failing to number 8 Alabama in the Southeastern Conference title game, Harbaugh and the Wolverines are poised finally to claim the top playoff seed and reach number 1. Harbaugh became the first coach in conference history to win three straight outright titles, and he celebrated by running evasively to avoid getting doused in a Gatorade bath. Harbaugh served a 3-game suspension over allegations of sign stealing and in-person scouting. Like I said earlier in the week, it felt great to have him, Corum said, referring to his coach. His enthusiasm, his presence means a lot. I love Coach Harbaugh. Michigan also extended its school record of consecutive wins over Big Ten foes to 25. Corum tied Anthony Thomas' school carrying career rushing TD mark. Corum, the league's running back of the year, finished with 16 carries for 52 yards. J.J. McCarthy, who was selected the conference's best quarterback this week, was 22 of 30 for 147 yards. For the Hawkeyes, it was more of the same. While the defense held stout, allowing the TDs on drives of 5 and 6 yards and 4 field goals, the offense produced just 155 yards and became only the second team in Big Ten title game history to be shut out in the final season of the East-West division format. Ohio State opened the era with a 59-0 rout over Wisconsin 59-0 in 2014. Deacon Hill went 18 of 32 with 120 yards, with Hawkeyes rushed for 35 yards on 24 carriers. The loss snapped a four-game winning streak and was the second in 3 years for Iowa in the title game against Michigan. The difference? The Wolverines capitalized on Iowa's errors. The Hawkeyes could not do the same. Michigan jumped out to a 10-0 lead after making a 35-yard field goal on its first possession, and Quorum powered in from 3 yards out. Two plays from Samaj Morgan broke free for an 87-yard punt, returned to a set Big Ten title game record. Quorum is the only FBS offensive or defensive player who has scored in every game this season. He scored again early in the second half when a replay review overturned an incompletion and ruled it was a fumble. Michigan recovered. Outgoing Iowa offensive coordinator Brian Ferentz compounded the problem by drawing a penalty for unsportsmanlike penalty, moving the ball to the 6. Following that, made it 17-0. Michigan closed it with 3 field goals, the final one being a 50-yarder from James Turner to set a title game record. Iowa's best scoring chance came after a 25-yard punt put at the Michigan 38. 3 plays later, through Jizian Patterson, lost a fumble at the Michigan 30. The takeaway: Iowa 2 streaks continued. The Big Ten West closes out the league division era going 0-10 in title games, and Hawkeyes still having not won a conference crown since 2004. Few gave, and its low-scoring offense, any chance Saturday night. Neither did the Wolverines. And that is the end of that article. Moving on to wrestling. This is consists of high school. The title is Glenwood Wins Dan Hill Invitational, Trainer Finishes Third at Home. This is by Peter Burnett. Dan Hill Invitational, Harlan, Iowa. The Glenwood Rams had 4 champions. At 157, Reese Fauble was injured in the first place match against winner sets Abe Bushong after pinning his first 2 opponents. At 165, first round pin earned Kellen Scott a place in the first place match, where he won 17-2 by Tech Fall at the 413 mark. At 175, Ian Connell advanced to the first place match with a 5-1 decision and 243 pin, lost by 9-4 decision Arian Isles. At 215, Mason Kohler pinned his first opponent at 243 and won by 10-4 decision to earn a spot in the first place match. Kohler lost to Elkerson's Mason Vilwalk by a slim 3-1 decision to finish runner-up. Finally, at 285, Trent Patterson eased through his first 2 opponents, pinning against 1 minute, but was pushed by Perry Kevin's Cullen in the first place match. Patton pinned Cullen with just 34 seconds left in the third round. Brody Black placed titled at 106. Trevor Cardinals boys invite Trainer Iowa. On day 3 of their home wrestling extravaganza, Trevor finished 3rd at the Cardinal Boys Invite on Saturday, December 2nd. St. Albert and Lewis Central also completed. The Cardinals were led by Jote Sorsen, winner at 126 pounds with a pair of first round pins and a 17-8 major decision in the first place match, and Danny Kinsella, winner at 150 with 2 pins, a decision 9-4, and a 9-0 major decision in the first place match. Zach Robbins, 175, and Levi Young, 190, placed 2nd, and Luke Parrott, 132, 3rd. For St. Albert, in 9th place, Sam Raymond, 144, rebounded from a loss via 7-2 decision in the semifinals, with back-to-back pins to clinch 3rd. Oliver Dronick, 126, Cohen Hamilton, 165, and Jaden Beckman, 215, all placed 4th. For Lewis Central, Jack Carnelison, 106, was the top finisher, placing 2nd by virtue of wrestling to a 2-1 record. Ethan Scalls, 113, placed 3rd, and Brayden Place 190, 4th as a Titans placed 11th as a team. Sergeant Bluff Luton invite. Sioux City, Iowa, Underwood, and Riverside both competed in Sioux City as a team while the Bulldogs were 10th. Barnum's path to the title at 113 pounds were through a pair of pins before winning by 3-0 decision against Sergeant Bluff Luton's Jace Curry. Taven Moore, 190, earned second place for the Bulldogs, losing to Logan Glenn and Nebraska's powerhouse Millard South. Caden Forstall won his fifth place match by 108 pin. For Underwood Bows, 144 pinned his first two opponents before winning major decision in the semifinals, 14-4, and a 9-3 decision in the first place match. Jones, 175, meanwhile pinned two of his three opponents to earn a spot in the first place match, where he defeated Spencer's Jace Follett by 9-3 decision. Carson Thompson, 132, won his first three matches to via pin and nearly went to overtime in the first place match before beginning pinned with 11 seconds left in the third round. Hayden Hune, 190, and Will Burcock, 175, both earned fourth place for the Eagles. And that is the end of that article. And that brings us to an end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for December 5th, 2023. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Catherine from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff, where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap, and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But, when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.